A sermon by Reverend Richard A. Rehm, preached at Christ Community Church in Spring Lake, Michigan, on December 30, 1990, entitled, I'm Afraid That... dot, dot, dot. The scripture readings are 1 John 4, verses 4 through 21, and Matthew 1, verses 18 through 25. The texts for the sermon are 1 John 4, verse 9, and Matthew 1, verse 20. Copyright, Grand Valley State University.
How many times have you heard the words come from another? I'm afraid that. I'm afraid that. I would like to do that, but I'm afraid that. I wanted to say, but I was afraid that. I had a dream to pursue, but I was afraid that. I didn't want to do it, but I was afraid that. Those words tumble out of our mouths so easily, so frequently. If you catch yourself, check yourself today before the day is over, you may well have said, in regard to one thing or another, I'm afraid that. It's not that there's something terrifying before us. It is not that we stand in the presence of some imminent danger. It's just the ordinary stuff of life. The ordinary stuff of every ordinary day. We continually say it, I'm afraid that. And those words well wear a well-worn path into our minds and into our souls. And before we know it, our lives are shaped, our behavior is formed by fear rather than love. I so much wanted to, but I was afraid that. In his little book, Life Signs, Henry Nouwen suggests that the whole world and all of us together dwell in the house of fear rather than in the house of love. We dwell in the house of fear, and our lives are characterized by survival questions. And we conjure up all of the peril that besets our fragile existence. What if? What if today? What if tomorrow? What if in this year that is now unfolding before us? Or the how questions. How can I possibly, how would I ever be able to? And constantly we go through our lives living in the house of fear, and we find ourselves saying in the ordinary experience of every day, I'm afraid that. The world lives in the house of fear. In the Middle East, fear hovers over the desert. And in this country, we're afraid that. We're afraid that we may be called to go to war, or we are afraid if we don't go to war that that menace may constantly be there. And in the Middle East, there must be fear aplenty. Fear in Baghdad, fear in Beirut, fear in Jerusalem. The whole world paralyzed by fear. It's really strange, isn't it? After all of these centuries, with so much wisdom in the world, so much knowledge, so much access to history and the tragic story that we have written together, isn't it strange that we will still play those games of threat and intimidation in order to instill fear in order to coerce, to manipulate, to control. Power games. Nouwen says that we dwell in the house of fear because our lives are so shaped by those who have power over us. Maybe it's a parent. Or maybe it's a boss. Or maybe it's a pastor or a bishop. Or maybe it's God. We are afraid. We are afraid because we dwell in the house of fear, because the world seems to run on fear. Love makes the world go round. Not so. Fear drives the world. And we are caught up in a fearful existence that is signaled every time there escapes from our lips those words, "I am afraid that." Fear, paralysis, the crippling of the human spirit, the truncating of the possibilities of our human existence. We dwell in the house of fear. Is it any wonder then that throughout the whole drama of God's redemption there appear as the preface to every significant move of God those words, "Fear not, do not be afraid"? Remember old ancient Abraham who received a word from God, he thought. Or maybe it was just a whim. But he took off, not knowing whither he was going. And in response to his faithful response, there came a word from the Lord. And the initial words were, "Fear not, Abraham, for you will have a child in your old age. And from the barrenness of Sarah's womb, the whole covenant of grace is created by a gracious God." And there was Zacharias, who rivaled Abraham in the impossibility of bearing children column. Perhaps not quite as old, but far too old. Linked with Elizabeth, whose womb was also barren. And when the angel came, the preface was, "Do not be afraid." It left him speechless. Wouldn't it have left you speechless? And of course, there was Mary, just an adolescent girl. And the angel Gabriel said, "Fear not, Mary." Easy for you to say, Gabriel. But the preface to that announcement, again, "Fear not." And to shepherds on the hillside, the angels sang a song, but before they began in chorus, the words were, "Fear not." And if we go beyond the gospel to the explosion of the Christian faith into the world, brought no more significantly by any other than Paul, who on Mars Hill, in the midst of the intelligentsia of the ancient world, gave his witness to Jesus Christ and got severely battered, putting his tail between his legs and heading off for Corinth, only to receive a night vision. The Lord saying to Paul, "Do not be afraid." It would seem that God's greatest problem is not our sin, but our fear. I would imagine God being God, God could handle our sin. We get the idea that we are so almighty important that our sin must be very important too. And so we conjure up this elaborate system whereby God can finally be gracious, whereby God can finally embrace God's children. We have this neat scheme of redemption in order to get God off the hook so he can love us. I think his problem is much more our fear than our sin. I think our sin is a rather insignificant matter in the light of the eternal God. It is our love that he cannot, it is our fear that he cannot break through. Why else would he come time after time after time bringing good news and have to preface it with the words, "Do not be afraid"? I imagine one day, sitting in the parapets of heaven, he must have scratched his head and said to himself, "How can I make them believe? How can I make them simply accept the fact that I accept them because they are mine?" Perhaps he scratched his head again, or hers for that matter, and said, "Perhaps if I came defenseless, they would drop their defenses. Perhaps if I came weaponless, they would lay down their arms. Perhaps if I came totally vulnerable, they would become vulnerable enough to hear my only word, my word of love." And so God came in a child. And that is the Christmas story. Love. Born in a child. Love made concrete and tangible when the Word became flesh and dwelt among us. For you see, love is not an abstract idea. It is not the greatest of all virtues free-floating in the air. Love is only love when it can be touched and handled and seen and tasted. Love is only love when it is enfleshed, when it is concrete. It seems to me that that's the slant on the Christmas story that we get from John's first letter, which was read for you, a passage of which was read for you a moment ago. But the letter begins in that very concrete manner. John writes, "It was there from the beginning. We have heard it. We have seen it with our own eyes, we looked upon it, felt it with our hands, and it is of this we tell. Our theme is the word of life." And he goes on then to speak of that word, and that word that was light and life. And he says that this word that came to be, this concrete and tangible expression of God in our midst, was for us. And not only for us, but for the whole world. The whole letter speaks of the great love that God has for us. And finally, in that fourth chapter, John just gets right down to it and says, "Let us love one another, because love is from God." He says it this simply: God is love. And he says God's love was disclosed in this, that he sent his only Son into the world. John's version of the Christmas story, the Word made flesh that dwelt among us. God is love, and God's love was disclosed in this, that the Word became flesh. And a defenseless child, in order to break through our defenses, in order to somehow or other convince us of the only reality that there is, and that is love. For God is love. And he goes on to say, if God thus loved us, dear friends, then we ought to love God. No, that's not what he says. That's what the church says. The church is always harping about how we ought to love God. We ought to love God. Dear people, you ought to love God. But we can't love God. How can you love one that you've never seen? For me to lay on your back the imperative to love God is ridiculous. And John doesn't write it that way. We cannot love God. John writes it this way. If God so loved us, then we ought also to love one another. Because love is not the highest of all virtues, free-floating in the ether somewhere. It is not some grand speculative idea or some abstract reality. Love is only love when it is enfleshed. Love is only love when it is handled. Love is only love when it is concrete. We cannot love God. God told us through centuries of an infinite love, and it never registered, for we were afraid that. We were afraid that if we should love like that, we would lose control, that we would be taken advantage of, that we might be exploited. No. No, we couldn't believe it until we could handle it, until love became enfleshed, because love is not the highest of all virtues, free-floating in the atmosphere. Love is only love when it is love embraced in the flesh of another. To love another person is to see the face of God. And there's no other possibility. Any other possibility is self-deceit, I'm afraid. And it has no reality. And it will not stand in the test. Only love, that is the love of another person, gives entree to the love of God. Not my idea. John's very clearly. If God thus loved us, dear friends, we in turn are bound to love one another. His love is brought to perfection within us. And a little further down, God is love. And he or she who dwells in love is dwelling in God, and God in him or in her. This is the perfection of love. God is love, and we cannot love God. Tell me you love God and do not love your brother or sister. John would say you are a liar, maybe not meaningfully, maybe not deliberately, but you're fooling yourself. If you cannot love the flesh that is before you, you cannot love the God who is the source of all love and all life. This is John's angle on the Christmas story. And you say to me, but I'm afraid that. Yes, I suppose Abraham was afraid too. What kind of lecture do you think his old father gave him when he said he heard this word from the Lord? Being a proper parent, I'm sure his father lectured him on moving out on whims. And do you think it was easy for him in the autumn time of his senility to believe that he and Sarah could produce a child? And Zacharias, the same problem. But what of Mary? We read the story so blithely, so easily. This was a young girl. When is the last time an adolescent came to you telling you about an angel visitant and a certain life she felt stirring within her womb? There was a young lady who went to the doctor. Seems as though morning after morning she wasn't feeling well. The doctor said, "You're pregnant." She said, "That's impossible." He got up from his desk and looked out the window. She said, "Doctor, what are you staring at?" He said, "Well, the last time a young lady said that, three kings appeared from the east." You think it was easy? Do you think her mother believed her? Her father? And of course, Joseph. Don't you think they had a drink or two at the expense of Joseph at Abie's pub in Nazareth? The old fool got suckered in on that story. The young girl wound him around her pinky. Joseph believed about angels and a conception by the Holy Spirit. Would you have believed it? Joseph might well have said to Mary, "Mary, I would, but I'm afraid to." And the angel came and said, "Joseph, don't be afraid to take Mary. Joseph, for once in your life, move out of the house of fear into the house of love. Joseph, for once in your life, do what your heart wants you to do. Joseph, for once in your life, follow your dream. Let love determine your action. Joseph, embrace the flesh of Mary and learn the love of God." And so, for you, would you, if you were not afraid? What would you do if you were not afraid? What would you say? To whom would you speak? What vision would you follow? What dream would you dream? If only you could get over those words, "I'm afraid that." Hear the Christmas story. The whole heart of the gospel. The only thing God has to say, it is, "Don't be afraid." Because all the myriad fears that truncate our existence are grounded by one haunting fear that we will be rejected and not be accepted. And the whole gospel story, the miracle of Christmas, is God's dramatic announcement that all there is love. And the only place that we can fall is into the abyss of love. And so, won't you believe that Nothing done in love. Nothing done for love will ever be lost. For God is love. Thank God.